The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
On News Talk.
Globally today, one of the big stories on the agenda, of course, is the confirmation yesterday that Benjamin Netanyahu got cabinet approval for the occupation of Gaza. A military occupation is what he is talking about. Still confusion as to whether he wants to put a timeline on it. But with me to discuss same is Ria Cherniak-Leboff, who is a NCAD lecturer here and a self-described voice of non-Zionist Judaism in Ireland. Ria, it's good to talk to you. And thanks a million for coming in to us.
Thank you very much for having me.
I mean, in terms of this kind of the latest development on this and the plans for a full occupation of Gaza, is that entirely surprising or was this the direction of travel for a long time?
It's not remotely surprising, and it shouldn't be surprising to anybody who's been following what's going on.
There has been much more vocal pushback from more quarters, it seems. I mean, even the Germans today remarkably saying we're going to halt munition sales to Israel if we suspect that they're going to be used in Gaza. Now, that the if is doing a lot of heavy lifting in that sentence. We'll have to wait and see how much munition sales are actually halted. But I mean, they have been the most stalwart supporters, kind of from a European point of view, an EU point of view of Israel. I mean, do you get a sense that the tide is slightly turning in terms of public opinion?
I think what's very dispiriting is that no matter how the tide turns, people are so complicit at this stage, both commercially and whether they're arming or we've got like just this week, there was a story that came out about the millions of hours of surveillance of people in Gaza that are stored in Microsoft cloud technology in Ireland and the Netherlands. And I think that people are making a lot of promises about recognition of a Palestinian state, but I absolutely think this would be a development in the right direction, but without actual sanctions and boycotts, it's kind of a gesture and Palestinians need more than that right now.
Well, what did you make actually of the conditions attached to that recognition in France and the UK in particular? We spoke to the British ambassador yesterday, Paul Johnston, you know, who explained that from their point of view. It seems unusual to me. I mean, let's imagine for a moment that Netanyahu's government, and I don't think they will, were to comply with those. It would imply that they won't recognise a Palestinian state.
They have absolutely no intention of recognising a Palestinian state. And I think what is very frustrating as somebody who's followed Middle Eastern politics for an awful lot longer before October 7th, is that I feel like people don't really listen. And if you're really listening closely to the words of Itamar Ben-Gvir and Bezalel Smotrich years ago, and you're looking at them doing presentations of maps of Greater Israel, in which Gaza is part of Greater Israel, but so are parts of Syria, Lebanon, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, you're not surprised to see this happening at all.
So, I mean, you as you say, then have been paying attention to all of this. What do you imagine is the ambition of those hardliners around the Israeli cabinet table beyond Gaza? Do they have territorial ambitions for those places you mentioned?
Absolutely. And you can already see.
How do they hope to manifest those plans?
Well, they already are. I mean, they're engaged in war on multiple fronts at the moment. But I was actually at a talk recently with representatives from B'Tselem and from Breaking the Silence. And they are two organisations on the ground in Israel and Palestine. And they were explaining how systematic the occupation of the West Bank is, like encroaching further and further on Palestinian towns. And I think people are obviously, the genocide that's taking place in Gaza is first and foremost on all of our minds and our radars, but you can't look at it separately from what's going on in the West Bank and in East Jerusalem. And I think it's so glaring there because this default position has been, this is about the hostages, this is about Hamas. And when you look at what's happening with the PA in the West Bank, it becomes abundantly clear that this is it's a master plan and it's a greater Israel expansionist project that we need to be able to, if they're capable of fighting on multiple fronts, we need to be able to look at all of the different approaches that they're utilising to take over.
And you know, supporters of the Palestinian cause and advocates for the two-state solution and the kind of the iteration of it born of Oslo and all of that would suggest that a lot of those settlements have to be dismantled. Do you see that happening?
Not under this government.
Could you see it, though, under an alternative Israeli government? I mean, how much appetite is there in Israeli society for the dismantlement of those illegal settlements?
I feel like at this stage that the, I guess, one thing that Israel are like is motivated by, let's say, would be they certainly don't want to be a pariah state that the rest of the world won't trade with. And I definitely think that under previous governments, there's been much harsher views and approaches taken to illegal settlements. But you have someone like I feel like sometimes people don't understand quite how extreme this coalition are. So like in 2022, when they went into government, like Israeli society was shocked. They did not want a radical right wing settler in power, which is what Bezalel Smotrich is. He was raised in a settlement and he's a lawyer, and he ran an election campaign claiming that he would legalize illegal settlements. And that's exactly what he's trying to do. So to be remotely surprised that any of this is happening is totally disingenuous at this stage, where it's willful ignorance.
The accusations of, say, anti-Semitism that would have been directed at Ireland and Irish politicians and what have you, it seems to me it's been harder for them to make that argument more recently as more and more countries. It was easy to suggest the Irish are anti-Semites, look at them kind of recognising the Palestinian state. It's harder for them to suggest, you know, France and Canada and the UK are anti-Semites, and now Germany are anti-Semites, and now the leading human rights organisations in Israel are anti-Semites, and lots of Israeli citizens are anti-Semites. What damage, though, did that argument do? You know what I mean? The use of the anti-Semitism charge so freely early on.
Well, I think that's a hugely problematic thing. And a lot of that stems from the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism, which was kind of brought in. It was developed in response.
That's the International Holocaust.
Yeah. Remembrance Alliance.
Yes.
And so for anyone who doesn't isn't familiar with the definition, and in a lot of ways, why would you be? The definition itself is fairly standard. So as far as I'm concerned, like, anti-Semitism is hatred of Jews because they're Jews. But what follows the definition is 11 different clauses. And I think, to the best of my knowledge, six of them refer to Israel. So when you've got a definition, like, what's horrifying, and you're saying about anti-Semitism, is that there is a genuine rise of anti-Semitism, a huge rise of anti-Semitism. And part of that is the conflation of Zionism and Judaism. Like, recently there was a man, an Israeli man, verbally abused to the point where a police officer had to be called on a Dublin bus recently, because I'm not sure whether he was wearing some sort of marker in solidarity with the hostages, but he was somehow identified as being Israeli. And this gentleman is shouting at him on a Dublin bus, "Jew, Jew, genocidal Jew." And when you've got a society that conflates Judaism and Zionism that badly, that you're holding all Jews accountable for war crimes, then that is really deeply anti-Semitic and problematic. And we need to look at why people presume that all Jews are supportive of a regime that's committing a genocide. But at the same time, under the IHRA definition, for example, it says the assertion that that Israel is a racist state, that's considered anti-Semitic. Denial of the right of Israeli self-determination, that's anti-Semitic. But it never predicates it on where the borders are. And it never mentions, like, as far as I'm concerned, if Israel and a Jewish state are entitled to self-determination, obviously Palestinian statehood is necessity. And air safety is contingent on Palestinian safety. And one doesn't have greater rights or entitlement than the other.
You know, sometimes government politicians here push back at the labelling of everything as a crisis. They say, you know, if everything's a crisis, nothing can be a crisis, and you undermine the value of the word. And I wonder whether there was the charge of anti-Semitism itself became undermined by how freely it was used, because, you know, people saw kind of the you know, the finger pointing, that's anti-Semitic. To criticize the Israelis, to criticize what they're doing in Gaza, you know, is deeply anti-Semitic, your position. And people could see, the dogs in the street knew it wasn't anti-Semitic, this kind of political position and opposition to what was happening. And then when genuine anti-Semitism is called out, it's easier for people to shrug it off and say, that's just more kind of pointless charges of anti-Semitism.
Absolutely. And there's such a historical connection between Zionism and anti-Semitism. And I think that's something that we need to be very careful of, because I've known people since growing up who, when they faced anti-Semitism, like I knew a French girl and their family did. They were faced with an awful lot of anti-Semitism and racism in France. And what did they do? They emigrated to Israel because it would feel safe. Now, that's, it kind of undermines statehood and the fact that, like, I feel deeply Irish. But I think that those two things aren't in conflict. And I don't think that, I don't believe in my heart in ethno-nationalism to keep yourself safe. I think, I believe in diplomacy and equity. And I think at this stage, the prospect of a two-state solution is a bygone fantasy. But you do need a state that has equity and equal rights, and you can't have an apartheid state.
Do you think it's a fantasy, the two-state solution that we imagined kind of post-Oslo?
Yes.
So what's the future then? If the future is imagined by those hardliners as a greater Israel, what's a realistic future?
I mean, I'm not a political scientist, but I think for the Israel are going to have to be invested in some sort of coalition or power share, that because even the cynicism of Israel claiming, well, we pulled out all the settlements in Gaza and look how Hamas have treated their civilians, or look how they weren't able to stand on their own 2 feet or be sustainable. But cynically, they pulled out all those settlements because then it's much easier to see them as an enemy. And when you've got an oppositional state, it's not maybe in your best interests to provide safety and to share resources. Like, I think a lot of people also don't understand, like I remember first reading about the gas, the offshore gas in Gaza, that Israel did not have the rights to sell, and Gaza would have independence, so financial independence, if they had access to all their natural resources that Israel has been basically redirecting or siphoning off for decades. Famously, like decades ago, they redirected the Jordan River to irrigate the Negev. And I just think if people properly understood what Israel has been doing ecologically and socially to Gaza, people might look at this situation differently.
And then in terms of the experience here, before I let you go, you know, mentioned that man on the bus, and people would have seen the video. That was the one that the video went around of. Yeah. You have a Star of David necklace on.
Yeah.
Have you been subject to anything like that? People notice that? Or put it this way, have you tucked that Star of David inside your jacket or your shirt at any times to try and avoid people noticing?
I think there are days where I don't feel like having conversations about politics with anyone. And yeah, I don't like the assertion that if you wear a symbol of your faith that you are open to having to either defend a state which you don't agree with.
A crucifix on a chain gets kind of questions about.
They certainly don't.
Kind of the kind of Lord's Liberation Army somewhere.
They don't. But
Africa.
At the same time, I feel like maybe I keep wearing it as an act of defiance. I don't feel like I would be devastated if Israel makes me so ashamed to be Jewish that I pretend that I'm not publicly. Like, if somebody wants to be anti-Semitic or racist towards me, that's on them. And yeah, I'm not going to change my belief system.
Has there been any pushback from the opposite direction when you've been critical of, like, kind of the Israeli state?
Yeah, absolutely. My father is actually from Tel Aviv, so half my family are in Israel, and I guess, like, if people follow me on social media or things that I write, like, I think first and foremost, obviously, what I would want people to do is listen to Palestinian voices. Because that's another thing about listening. It's like, why does it take Louis Theroux going to the settlements for us to take seriously what's happening? We've seen documentation of it for decades, and it shouldn't take somebody from the West to go over there and highlight the plight when people are telling us exactly what's happening. But the reason I guess I feel like I need to speak out also is because the amount of Jewish or Zionist and Israeli family I have who tell me that I've been brainwashed by Western media. And so I do make it my business to follow a lot of Israeli activists on the ground and to read Haaretz and the Jerusalem Post and see what they're seeing and try to understand how people have maintained that belief in a system that I just think is immoral at this stage.
What are they seeing? I mean, how has, when you go on, is it, I can't remember, is it the Israeli, which the Jerusalem Post or Haaretz, or one of them has kind of a day counter, Israel at war, you know, 700 and something odd days or whatever it happens to be. Because when I was on the website earlier, to what extent are ordinary citizens in Israel exposed to a kind of a version of wartime propaganda from the media?
It's just even Haaretz, which would be the equivalent of The Guardian, like it, the way that language is used is shocking from where we are. Just things that they perceive as being revelations are absolutely the most softened versions of events. And I think even recently there was an article about the kind of imagery that's being shown in Israel where until about a month or two ago, they were saying that they were seeing an awful lot of devastation of like buildings and things looking like quite an apocalyptic landscape that we've seen for over a year, but they weren't seeing child casualties. And I think that's why it's very, very telling that the protesters in Tel Aviv are doing sit-ins and marches holding images of children starving and children who've passed away, because that's just so important that people see the human cost in this. It's not collateral damage. And as soon as you start saying, well, Hamas brought this upon their people, you're like, no, if you're literally making an entire region uninhabitable or between deaths and injuries, it's probably up to about 200,000 people. Like, that's not proportionate, and it's collective punishment and it's a war crime.
Listen, thanks a million for coming into us. Really appreciate it. Ria Cherniak-Leboff.
The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
Weekdays from 4 on News Talk.